Welcome to the Commune Podcast. My name is Jeff Krasno. Today, I am thrilled to feature yet another fascinating episode in our series called Ask Dr. G. Now, here at Commune, we are consistently in receipt of really interesting questions from you, our Commune community, regarding health and well-being. And I simply cannot imagine anyone better to answer these inquiries than my friend, Dr. Sarah Gottfried. Dr. G is a Harvard-educated physician, researcher, and educator. She received the moniker of Dr. G from the Philadelphia 76ers, for whom she serves as health coach. She has led numerous Commune courses on the topics of perimenopause and menopause. And happily, we seem successful in luring her up to Commune Topanga on a regular basis, where she is leading retreats with my better three-quarters, Skylar Grant. So you can be part of the conversation and submit your question at onecommune.com/askdrg, and maybe we'll pick it. So to learn even more from Dr. G, you can watch her free Commune Masterclass, Women, Food, and Hormones, at onecommune.com/menopause. Before we dive in, I want to say that I'm so grateful to those of you who write us reviews on Apple Podcasts that our team created a special offer just for you, 30 days of free Commune membership. That's all access for a whole month. Just scroll down to the review section and tap write a review. Then email support@onecommune.com with a screenshot of your review, preferably a good one, to receive your free all access for 30 days. Okay, today's episode is the second installment of a two-parter where Dr. G and I discuss healthy adaptive stress responses versus unhealthy and maladaptive responses to stress. In this installment, we dig into how trauma in childhood shapes our adult experiences of adversity. I even share with Sarah a story from my own childhood that has stuck with me into adulthood. But good news, together, we propose how these traumatic experiences as children can be transmuted into our superpowers. When they're addressed appropriately, we have the opportunity to become more resilient and even empathetic. As always, this was a fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Okay, without further delay, I present to you Dr. Sarah Gottfried.
So for people who aren't aware of it, what is the ACE questionnaire?
ACE questionnaire stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. So we've got a link on our website to do the questionnaire, which is in the public domain. And it started out as a 10-point questionnaire, looking at things like physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect.
Yeah. More capital T stuff. That was at least how I interpreted it.
Capital T, although some people would say neglect, you know, there's a spectrum of neglect.
True.
You know, having a parent that went to prison, having a parent or caregiver who had an addictive process, having parents who divorced.
Yeah, that was one box I checked.
Me too.
Yeah. I scored fairly low on the more traditional 10 question ACE. I was a 2. And, you know, maybe I can share with you one of my traumatic childhood experiences that I've been able to recognize, but I haven't been able to fully treat. But maybe before that, do you mind sharing where you were on the ACE?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, 2 is still elevated. So it does increase your risk of a number of chronic diseases, including prediabetes and the development of metabolic dysfunction. Mm-hmm. What we know based on the original study that was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente is that when you look at middle-aged people, so 40 to 65, and you ask them about the ACE questionnaire, what happened before they were 18, having a score of 1 or higher is associated with about 45 different chronic diseases in middle age. Hmm. So that was the first study to show this association.
let me just drill into that. So if you just even check one box out of the 10, you have a much greater predisposition for the development of like 45 different diseases.
You have a significant increased risk of, I don't know if it's all 45, but you know, certainly for some of the bigger ones. And my score is 6. So I've got a pretty high ACE score. So, you know, this is not one of those tests that you want a high score on. It's out of 10, the original study. I also use the Institute for Functional Medicine, which has a different denominator.
Right.
But for, you know, an ACE score of 6 puts me at risk of pretty much all of those chronic diseases. And they range from cardiovascular disease to diabetes to autoimmune disease to depression, alcohol use disorder. There's a long list. And it's important to know this because a lot of people don't connect the dots. And they've got trauma that lives on in their system that might be taking them on this journey toward a chronic disease. And they don't realize that it's within their power to potentially resolve that trauma, resolve that biological embedding, and reduce their risk of chronic disease.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as simple as drawing a straight line from like these 6 that I checked to this disease, though one can certainly find the physiological causes or chains of events that do lead there. In your life, in your case, you know, how were you able to connect your score of 6 to some of your infirmities?
Well, going back to that experience I had in my 30s, I had a cortisol that was 3 times what it should be. And I am sure that is related to some of the trauma that I experienced. And it's not just childhood trauma. You know, I chose a career that is traumatizing. I chose a career where you're dealing with life or death on a daily basis, and you're often dealing with it on no sleep and no food. And I'll invoke Gabor Mate here. He talks about how medicine selects for people who are traumatized because it's like a cult. Mm-hmm. You know, you join this group, they cut you off from your family. You wear a weird outfit, scrubs. You're not allowed to eat when you want to. You can't go to the bathroom when you want to. I'm not complaining. I'm not saying, you know, I'm a victim here, but medicine selects for people who are traumatized.
Thank God they have these really nice fitted scrubs now. Have you seen these?
They've gotten better. They've gotten better, for sure. Like,
I might adopt some scrubs.
Yeah, yeah. They're like cozy.
Hello, Commune listeners, it's Jeff, and if you are looking for science-backed recommendations to take control of your own health, well, we have an exciting opportunity coming up. Dr. Andrew Huberman, the well-known neuroscientist and host of the number one health and fitness podcast, Huberman Lab, will be hosting an exclusive live webinar for the Commune audience on September 22nd at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Now, in this 45-minute live learning session, he will be sharing the best daily and weekly trackable health metrics, everything from sleep quality to nervous system recovery, as well as less frequent tests to consider, including blood, cognitive, and DNA testing. Now, to sign up, both to attend live and to receive the video replay of the webinar, just go to onecommune.com/health. I'm personally so excited to hear what Andrew will be sharing about how to objectively measure your health and performance and how to use those metrics to optimize your health. So go to onecommune.com/health to RSVP. This event is made possible by Inside Tracker, the leading longevity and health span optimization platform. Inside Tracker analyzes your biological data to give you a clear picture of what's going on inside your body and then provides a customized action plan based on your biology. I personally use Inside Tracker and I love it. So get 20% off Inside Tracker by visiting insidetracker.com/commune.
So I'll share with you briefly this experience that I had when I was in seventh grade. And maybe you can help me unpack it, because I can cognitively put my thumb on it, but I can't seem to exercise it, if you will.
Yes.
So, you know, I had a group of friends, boyfriends, who, I mean, boys have a very strange way of demonstrating their affection for one another. I have three girls, you know, they can be catty, but generally sweet. But yeah, I was walking down with my guys this one particular hallway at South School in Canaan, Connecticut. And, you know, we were like flicking each other's ears and giving each other, you know, what's when you step on the back of someone's shoe, like a flat tire, right?
Yes.
You know, and this was just like very commonplace between boys who like each other. It's like, I like you, I'm gonna flick your ear lobe.
Let me hurt you a little.
Let me hurt you. And unfortunately, in my case, that phenomena sort of spiraled a little out of control, and they pushed me into a locker. And this is a kind of very, very narrow, typical school locker, and then closed and shut the door on it. And I mean, I'm still kind of unaware of how much time I spent in there. You know, it felt obviously like a lifetime. Could have been only 90 seconds. But as you can imagine, I went into complete amygdala hijack and, you know, screaming, pounding. And in retrospect, as I've tried to unpack it, I realized that my reaction probably inhibited them from letting me out because they were so petrified or scared or shocked themselves by my reaction. But it was as intense of a sympathetic experience as I've ever had. And then they finally did let me out, and I came out like a whirling dervish and sort of like a, you know, fire hose of like snot and saliva and, you know, just like swinging at anything, anyone, and then kind of collapsing, you know, on the ground. And of course, at this juncture, you know, there was a significant assembly of kids, girls, you know, other boys to impress or embarrass yourself in front of. So there was that acute experience. And then there was kind of the shame that, you know, for the rest of the year, I was like, that guy that got stuck in that got locked in the locker, you know, that was like the whisper. And the way that carries forward, at least in my very, very non-clinical assessment of it, is that, yeah, I am hyper claustrophobic. Like, I will not get on an airplane if I'm in the middle seat. Mm-hmm. I just won't get on, you know, like, sorry, I'll fly later. But just being on an airplane, being in, you know, a steel tube 40,000 feet in the sky doesn't tickle my fancy. I will do it, but it is a, you know, I have to work myself up to it. But it goes beyond just sort of elevators and tight spaces. It goes into any situation that I cannot extricate myself from. So there is a lack of control and a lack of power. And it shows up physically in severe acute nausea. And it's still all the time. I mean, even with like podcasts, you know, I'm pretty comfortable here, you know, it's my own house. But like oftentimes, like I'll see a little hint of that. And then certainly in bigger situations where like a high pressure meeting inside of a small office, oh, that is like paroxysms of nausea and anxiety. So I can recognize it, but here I am with almost every tool in the toolkit.
Right.
But I haven't been able to tame the wild beast of the physiological symptoms.
First, thank you for sharing the story. It sounds, you know, I felt like I was back there with you that experience of being in seventh grade and being shoved into a locker. What I feel as you describe it, just feels so much compassion and love for seventh grader Jeff. And there's a way that you were forced to freeze. You were forced by being stuck in this locker not to be able to fight. Mm-hmm. So for whatever period of time, you were frozen in this helpless situation without agency. And that is terrifying. That is a terrifying situation in terms of stress response. Mm-hmm. And then you superimpose on that being a seventh grader. So you were probably 13, something like that.
12. Yeah,
12, 13. And this is right at the time where this hormonal symphony is starting. So you've got more testosterone. You've got this development of community, kinship, connection with other people, like that becomes increasingly important right at the time of puberty. So in some ways, it sounds like a perfect storm and a traumatic situation that still, as you describe, kind of lives on in your body and has these after effects, the nausea that you described and that sense of, you know, never again wanting to be put in a situation where you have that feeling of helplessness. Mm-hmm. And then the shame response. As you said, you finally got out of the locker. You had girls around. You had other kids who witnessed this. And in some ways, that kind of re-traumatizes the entire experience. Mm-hmm. Because shame does that. I really want to thank you for sharing it because, you know, people look to you, they look at what you've built with your media empire. They look at the way that you live your life, the way that you bring so much consciousness and so many rituals and practices, and you wear a continuous glucose monitor and you add your sauna and your cold shower, like you do all the things.
I pay my taxes.
You pay your taxes.
I raise my children.
And yet these are things that take us back to that moment, that incredibly vulnerable moment. Mm. And I want to talk about hope for a moment. Because what I've seen, I just finished 3 certifications in psychedelic-assisted treatment. And so I've really seen people who are able to take a memory like this and walk through it with a different response. And they're able to kind of complete that feeling of terror and that feeling of helplessness. They're able to move through it and resolve it. And I also, this is a little more edgy. I feel like there's a way that some of our experiences, like my ACE score of 6, maybe you get to decide, maybe this experience you had as a seventh grader, there was something about that experience that compelled me to develop a capacity to be seen and heard authentically for who I am. Mm-hmm. And to have a sensitivity and an awareness of other people who've gone through something similar that I don't think I would have had if I had an ACE score of 0. So I wonder about that. Such a vulnerable thing. Oh my gosh, the locker.
Maybe 2 months ago, I was up at the club, as you can imagine, I was. And there was like a group of boys playing in the locker room. Mm. And one of the boys, small, like these boys were more like 6, something, 7. One of the boys, they locked him in the locker. And I just went nuts.
Yes.
And it was like, I just was like, I mean, I'm not sure I overreacted, but of course it obviously struck a very, very personal chord. And I was like, ran over there and let him out. I said, you boys, I don't know who you are, but you cannot do this. You cannot lock anyone into soccer.
That's right.
I do think that you know, is an indication, like you say, that if your ACE score hadn't been a 6, you probably would not as easily identify someone else's suffering as your own, right? So that as the definition of compassion, right? So to truly identify someone else's suffering as your own suffering. And of course, and not only that, but feel the compelling need to alleviate that suffering, and also to feel other people's joy, like empathic joy, for yes. example. So in many ways, yes, we can leverage, you know, these inflection points, these experiences in our life for our own, call it spiritual growth. And because we both likely fall into the highly sensitive category, and I have a daughter that does too, I see the work that she does in the world. She works once a week with kids on the autism spectrum. And because she sees some of herself in them. So we can transmute some of these experiences into superpowers. I think that's the good news. That's the hope. I think the pitfall, the trickiness along the way is not to get sick ourselves.
Yes.
So like when you say freeze or fawn, I think about fawn all the time. Think about, okay, I mean, even in the context of that one experience, I was like, the rest of the year, I was sort of like trying to impress people and shake it off and seem tough and blow it off and, you know, just to try to win curry favor in other people's eyes, yeah. as if their judgment of me was the ultimate arbiter of my self-worth. And you carry that along like a rucksack into your adult life. Many of us, you know, me included. Yeah, it's something that, anyways, I'm still working on it.
But it also makes me wonder, you know, when you feel into this horrible thing that happened to you in seventh grade, is there a way that it resonates with some epigenetic change that you've inherited? Like, is it bigger? I mean, it's big enough, that trauma that you experienced, mm-hmm. but you don't know about, you know, a similar experience of torture in your history.
Yeah. It's certainly possible. I mean, you know, I started to get into Rachel Yehuda's work, and I know you mentioned her in the book, and essentially how acquired traits and behaviors can be passed down transgenerationally. So I know she studied the 9/11 victims, but also famously like the Holocaust families in, I think, Cleveland, somewhere in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And you know, she was testing them and they had this high prevalence of PTSD. And then they're like the P1 first generation progeny, even though they grew up in sort of like middle class Cleveland, they also had the symptoms of PTSD, very much among, highly prevalent among the women. And then the same cortisol profiles. And at first it was actually, I couldn't get my head around it because they were actually chronically low cortisol
yes.
levels.
Yes.
And I
she,
was like,
she couldn't get her head around it either.
Yeah. But then it seems like because of the dysregulated stress response and the high cortisol production for a certain period of time, the receptor sort of dysregulated
yes.
such that then there was this like inverse reaction in terms of the adrenal creation of cortisol, which ended up leading to these very like low cortisol states, which have their own sets of issues.
That's right.
So
that's right. Yeah, she found this first with Vietnam veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was a head scratcher. And she was like, I would expect to find high cortisol. Why am I seeing low cortisol?
Right.
And she found it, as you described, in families that survived the Holocaust and looking at offspring, and also in those that survived 9/11 and the women that were pregnant in 9/11 and looking at their their babies. And so it does seem to be a dysregulated system, that there's this period of high cortisol followed by a period of low cortisol. And part of what's interesting to me as a scientist is that it's actually the low cortisol state, mm-hmm. kind of the flat diurnal pattern,
right,
that is the most immune dysregulating. Mm. Like, that's the worst out of all of them, mm-hmm. more so than high cortisol.
Right, because cortisol is an immunosuppressant, really, right? So, I mean, you can get cortisone shots or whatever as an immunosuppressant when you have overactive inflammation, right? So it would seem to follow, and of course, this is a very layman's understanding here, but that a low cortisol may lead to a lack of immunosuppressants, sort of essentially like overactive immune response.
And that's the pattern we see. So people yeah. with autoimmune disease tend to have low cortisol patterns, low diurnal patterns, low cortisol awakening response. Mm. We also see that in anxiety. We see it in post-traumatic stress disorder, as I mentioned. So there's a constellation of symptoms. What's important there, what's happening to the larger immune system is mm-hmm. less understood. But when you look at the enzyme that converts cortisol to cortisone, and that's like 11 beta HSD, something like that, that's one of the enzymes that becomes dysregulated by exposure to trauma. And it's not just the work of Rachel Yehuda. There's another really interesting study, and I can't remember if we've talked about it before. It's called Project Ice Storm.
Oh, is this in Montreal?
Yes. One? Yes.
Yeah, I did read about that. It's not Rachel Yehuda, but it's another fascinating study.
It's a fascinating yeah. study. So it's the study of this terrible ice storm that went through Canada, where people were, they were isolated in their homes for about 2 weeks, no heat, no power. And they looked at the women who were pregnant. This happened, I think, around 1998 or something yeah, like that. Right. So now the offspring of the women who were pregnant are in their 20s. And what they found is that the genes that got changed in terms of epigenetic changes, so these are like little paper clips that get put on the DNA, the genes that got changed were in two classes, metabolism and immune function. Mm. Those are the two that got changed by this traumatic experience. And so it makes sense yeah. when you look at things like autoimmunity, when you look at the risk of type 2 diabetes and metabolic dysfunction, it makes sense that trauma is changing the expression of those genes.
Thanks so much for listening to our Ask Dr. G series. As I mentioned, we have a special offer for those of you who review the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does make a big difference in the discoverability of the show, so I'd really appreciate it. And by writing a review, you can receive all access to the Commune course platform, which now features over 150 courses on health and wellness for a whole month. Just scroll down to the review section and tap write a review, then email support@onecommune.com with a screenshot of your review to receive your free all access for 30 days. Of course, feel free to reach out to me directly any old time at jeffk@onecommune.com. Lastly, but certainly not leastly, I would like to thank the folks that make this show possible week over week, including Jacob Laub, Megan Stone, Violet Augustine, Cooper Mall, Silvana Alcala, Wellington Gonzalez, and Ryan Tillotson, the A-Team. That's all from the Commune for today. My name is Jeff Krasno, and I am here for you.